studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
Tom Shakespeare.
Why should Earl Grey be the Coalition's cup of tea? Could you bear to stand in the North Sea with St Cuthbert preaching to the seals? Do you think that the Scots are best kept the other side of Hadrian's Wall? Or would you rather just let the train take the strain? These are among the questions which shall be explored in the New Histories of the Northeast, a special series of the essay recorded live at the Sage Gateshead as part of the Free Thinking Festival this autumn.
The essay from Radio 3's Free Thinking.
So make a date to hear me, Tom Shakespeare, together with some of the Northeast's leading writers, tell you why for over 1,000 years our beautiful region has been the intellectual and cultural powerhouse of England.
Weekdays this week at 11 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And now Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Arabella Weir is a comedian, actress and writer. Her most recent book is The Real Me Is Thin, and that follows the enormously successful Does My Bum Look Big In This?, which I think came from one of your shows, didn't it, that phrase?
It was my catchphrase, or it was the catchphrase of a character called Insecure Woman in the Fast Show. Yes, I certainly had the conviction before I became a comic actress that if I were thinner, everything would be perfect. And my bete noire was my large bottom. Yes, and then I thought perhaps the best thing would be to out my neurosis. And so...
And you've done rather well out of it.
Yes, my bum has been very...
productive.
Productive indeed. It's paid for its own upkeep. Yes, I hit pay dirt when I outed my bum.
But on a more serious note, the way in which people treat young girls, and this certainly happened to you reading your book, can be quite sort of dangerous, really, because it creates a fixation, and then you've got all modern fashion, which then complements that. So people end up worrying in a way they probably didn't centuries ago, or did they always, do you think?
No, I think in modern society, and by modern I would have said from, say, post-war, there has been an unhealthy obsession with women looking a very narrow way. I don't mean narrow or physically, although I mean that as well. I dare say if I were ever to do a kind of feminist analysis, a historical feminist analysis, it seems to be that the more women have emerged as potential equals, i.e. in the workplace, the more society has expected them to look not like women, or rather not more uniform. And partly why I wrote this book is because despite my parents' unusually high levels of education, I don't mean unusually, I mean comparative to the rest of the world, they still wanted what somebody who didn't think about things much wanted, which was a thin, pretty daughter, despite the fact that I'd shown no signs of being thin from when I was born. So they weren't in pursuit of somebody likely to be a doctor or a lawyer or somebody highly skilled. They were first and foremost in pursuit of somebody who was going to be conventionally pretty.
Well, you've chosen some finely honed music. And the first piece, I think, comes from your first exposure to opera.
This is not actually my first exposure to opera. My first exposure to opera was The Magic Flute, which I think a lot of children of people who are interested in opera get taken to as a, in quotes, easy opera. But Don Giovanni, the piece I've chosen here, was the first time I was not being, as it were, force-fed opera and was genuinely responding to it. I mean, I was completely captivated, and I saw, as an acting student, I saw Joseph Losey's film of Don Giovanni. Nobody'd made me go. I went to see it of my own volition, and I was just blown away at how accessible and kind of immediate it was. It's also the skill required of the singer. It's such a simple piece, and it's so evocative and moving. And he's actually rather a wet character. He's not a particularly well-written character, but this is just a beautiful aria. And it's maybe what they did is said, it's not such a great character, but you'll have that lovely aria. And yes, I'd like to be able to sing it if I were a bloke. But I think it'd be hard not to like this, whatever you knew or didn't know about opera.
Il mio tesoro from Don Giovanni, Act 2 by Mozart, the Joseph Losey film soundtrack, which starred Kenneth Riegel as Don Ottavio with the Paris Opera Orchestra conducted by Lorin Maazel. Interesting that films have brought classical pieces to a much wider audience. One thinks of Death in Venice and the Mahler. One thinks of Elvira Madigan and the Mozart Piano Concerto 21. Do we need a visual image, do you think, sometimes, to actually take us into this world? Or is the sound just enough? Because it does bring it to a wider audience.
Yes, although I think one of the unique aspects of that film is that it makes an entire opera completely accessible. I do think it is quite hard to listen to an entire opera, whoever it's written by, unless you've got the visual pleasure. And that's such a joyful production, that movie. And it's so vibrant, and you really get the kind of sex appeal of Don Giovanni. I mean, however you manage to convey it, then I'm sure you need the visual aid to get through an opera. Less so, I would have said, for a piano piece, but my God, you need it to get through an opera.
Well, actually, we have, Arabella, we're not a visual aid to this, but we do have a memory which will give us a sort of visual aid, not to mention one laden with expletives, which we will imagine, and I'm saving your blushes, not that I think you'd really blush to this, but by saying that we have to imagine your father's expletives, which I think accompanied renditions of this piece, didn't they, when you were young?
Yes, Dad was a very good pianist, but on his own admission, he was very lazy. There had been talk, apparently, when he was at school in Dunfermline, of being a professional concert pianist. But I think for various reasons, not least of all, because as I say, he was lazy and didn't practice enough. But he was apparently pretty good, didn't practice enough. And then the war meant different things happened, the Second World War, and his career went a different way. But
he was in the Foreign Office.
He was in the Foreign Office.
And so you travelled around quite a bit.
We travelled around a lot. Mm. And there was always a piano wherever we were. That was Dad's, either Dad's own piano, or when he had grander posts, there would be a piano in the house you'd be given. And Dad would always play. He played a lot, but he didn't practice enough. He played a lot. And so he would, being competitive, even with himself, set himself quite hard pieces to do and then swear a lot when he got them wrong as he played them. So you couldn't hear this piece, for example, or many other Schubert pieces without hearing F, 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 F at the same time as he played them.
Thank you. Well, that was the scherzo, allegro vivace, con delicatezza, e non FFF.
Yes, quite.
From Schubert's piano sonata in B-flat, Deutsch 960. And the pianist was Alfred Brendel. The next piece you used, actually, in one of your shows, didn't you, Arabella Ware?
Yes. I wrote a show with John Cantor called Posh Nosh, which was inspired by the, in my view, ridiculous plethora of cooking shows, but many of which, to me, are saying, this is what you do if you care about good food, but you fat oaf, will just eat fish fingers and chips. So it was about the snobbery of cooks, and about, to me, making a joke of the impossibility of cooking on a daily basis, you know, risotto with squid ink and, you know, scallops and all that kind of thing. You think, no, I'm just trying to feed children. I can't do this. So the idea was that it was a cook with her very obviously gay husband, played by Richard E. Grant, impeccably. And while we were filming, I kept walking around singing the Alfred Della version of this and in a sort of silly rendition of his voice. And everyone just thought that that was perfect for the show because it's sort of... It, of course, isn't pretentious, but I think that people like these cooks were supposed to be would think it was very fine, and their interest in it would have been pretentious for what they thought it would say about them. And our parents used to play this all the time. And of course, when we were kids, we thought it was hilarious, as my kids do now, that this is a man.
Three gypsies stood at the castle gate. They sang so high. The lady sat in her chamber late, her heart it melted away as snow. They sang so sweet, they sang so shrill, that fast the tears began to flow, and she laid down her silken gown. A golden ring on her shoe. She plucked off her high-heeled shoes, and made of Spanish leather. She would in the street with her bare feet, all out in the wind and weather. Oh, saddle to me my milk-white steed, and go and fetch me my pony, that I may ride and seek my bride, who is gone with the rattle-tangle gypsies all. Oh, he rode high and he rode low, he rode through wood and copses too, until he came to an open field. And there he espied his lady, oh. What makes you leave your house and land, your golden treasures for to go? What makes you leave your new-wedded lord to follow the raggle-taggle gypsies, oh? What care I for my house and my land? What care I for my treasure? What care I for my new-wedded lord? I'm off with a raggle-taggle gypsies, oh. Last night you slept on a goose feather bed, with the sheet turned up so bravely, and tonight you'll sleep in a cold open field, along with the raggle-taggle gypsies, oh. What care I for a goose feather bed, with the sheet turned down so bravely, for tonight I shall sleep in a cold open field, along with the raggle-taggle gypsies, oh.
I can only think of my older brother Matthew singing that, and the "She'd stand down so bravely," oh, just crying with laughter. But it's great.
The way you set it up, one cannot help but see the funny side of it. Alfred Deller sang the Raggle Taggle Gypsies, a traditional air, accompanied on the guitar by Desmond Dupre. So now we come, Arabella, we're to, I think what you see as being your first wrestling with serious music.
Yes, Beethoven is harder than Mozart, let's say. I wouldn't say ever that he was better, but he's probably harder.
He's more turbulent.
Yes, and it's harder to access Beethoven. I mean, this is obviously a sweeping generalisation, but I would have said if you play a piece of Mozart next to a piece of Beethoven to 100 people, they'd find the Mozart more accessible. So this piece was very much the sort of music I would have resisted as a teenager. And I'd have just thought, oh, you know, oh, it's not very tuneful or something, you know. But anyway, I would have had a natural resistance to classical music because I was being told I had to like it all the time anyway. And I came across this piece and thought, oh, that's more complicated than the pieces I normally like, and I really like it. And this would have been in my early 20s. So, if you like, this is my first Proust novel.
Thank you.
I realised listening to it again that it's pulling in two directions. There's the sort of angry, almost sounding violin against countering the piano. And then it's sort of, you know, pull, 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 and then come back together when it gets sort of softer. And that's very, you're waiting, or I'm waiting for those sort of soft bits, but enjoying the kind of frenetic middle bits. I like that very much about that.
That was the first movement, the Allegro Vivace con Brio, from Beethoven's Piano Trio in D, Opus 70, number 1, also known as The Ghost, played by the great Beaux-Arts Trio. As somebody who deals with words, both as an actress and as a writer, do you find in the abstraction of music, the fact that it's not specific, as it were, a kind of freedom, that your mind is not being told precisely where to go, but you can bring your own world to it?
Very much so, especially with pieces like that. You know, the fact there are no lyrics. I mean, you know what you're supposed to feel when you listen to a soul song, you know, and I like Aretha Franklin and Al Green, people like that, very much. But you know what you're supposed to feel, and if they're artists like them, you'll feel it immediately. But you aren't being told what to feel when you listen to music like that, and therefore you can sort of luxuriate in it without, you know, you don't have to worry about, oh, should I be feeling this? Am I having the right reaction? So, yes, I like listening to non-lyrical music.
We've heard, Arabella Weir, music that has been clearly influenced by your father, and now I think we come to something that your mother loved.
Yes, both my parents liked Kathleen Ferrier, but particularly my mother. And it's not actually Kathleen Ferrier's singing of this song. It's more that it is the song, because my mother used to sing this to us when we were kids, and she was not a be-aproned cake-making mother by any stretch of the imagination. She was a blue stocking, really. But she did used to sing this, not to the end, because Mum didn't like to finish things, but she did like to sing this, and it's not actually, I think, a Scottish song, but to me it evokes Scotland, where both my parents were from, because she used to sing it to us on holiday in Scotland.
South o'er the bonny blue sea. Blow the wind southerly, southerly, southerly. Blow, bonny breeze, my lover, to me. They told me last night there were ships in the offing, and I hurried down to the deep rolling sea. But my eye could not see it, wherever might be it, the bark that is bearing my lover to me. Southerly, 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 blow, bonny breeze, o'er the bonny blue sea. Blow the wind, southerly, 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 blow, bonny breeze, and bring him to me. Is it not sweet to hear the breeze singing as lightly it comes o'er the deep rolling sea? But sweeter and dearer by far 'tis when bringing the bark of my true love safety to me.
There is a haunting kind of plangency to her voice, isn't there? And it's a beautiful tune, isn't it?
Yes, and we used to listen to her quite a lot because my father worked in the Middle East a lot when my parents were still together. And in those days, there was no, a television if you'd had one, would only have shown local stations in the Middle East, and obviously they weren't accessible to us. So we listened to much more music and stuff like that and Alfred Deller than we probably would have done if we'd been brought up in Britain from when we were all born. So I, you know, I probably had more access to Kathleen Ferrer and Alfred Deller, never mind the classical music, than I would have done if I'd been brought up in this country.
To what extent do you think the breakup of your parents' marriage added to the sort of catharsis to do with one's body?
Not. Not catharsis. I think it compounded my terror that I wasn't pleasing them. And I think a lot of children of divorced parents feel this, that had one, the child, been more pleasing, things would have been easier for them. I mean, they certainly, both of them certainly made me feel as if me being overweight was specifically to annoy them rather than a sort of genetic, amongst other things, coincidence. So there was, I think I got most unhappy about my size and stuff. I mean, I'm making it sound like the size of a house, but it's irrelevant how fat or not fat you are. It's how you think of yourself. Mm. And I definitely think that around the time they broke up, when I was about 9, and it took a long time off and on for them to properly break up, that compounded how sort of insecure I felt. I mean, as I've said, both my parents were Scottish, and the idea that anything was in abundance, food, love, anything, was just not part of your makeup. It was, everything is finite, you must earn everything, and nothing's here to be enjoyed. Maybe the bit of classical music, maybe something that would improve you, but certainly not a piece of cake. That's just, I mean, you know, that way indulgence lies, self-indulgence lies, and, you know, you don't win wars by eating cake.
Luckily, Mozart is always fairly, I mean, can be quite profound, but always has a kind of lightness to him, doesn't he? A felicitousness.
Yes, which is why he's apparently easier than other composers. This piece is very pleasing and feels weighty enough to be okay to like.
You can taste with impunity.
Yes, and you know, complicated enough to make me be able to feel okay about liking it. God, I'm still so struck.
Thank you.
be interesting to know, if one ever could, if Mozart was autistic. Because if you think of how childlike he apparently was in every other area of his life, and then compare to achieving that amongst all the other things, I mean, it's just so interesting that somebody who was so dissolute in every possible way, apart from as a musician, where that comes from. I mean, clearly his dad pushed him in that direction, but like the Williams sisters' father pushed them to tennis. But it's always fascinating what happens to the rest of a person's life and personality.
We heard Claudio Arrau playing the first movement of the piano sonata in A minor, Kirkel 310 by Mozart. Actually, I have to say, in that piece, I thought it might be noble grit, but there was real grit there. It wasn't just dancing. There was something quite deep and profound in it.
It's definitely a profound piece of music, but it's, I would say, still pretty accessible. Mm-hmm. You're not having to work too hard to get through your greens to earn those nice, trilly, sort of joyful bits at the top of the piano. So it's still easier to get to than Beethoven.
Talking of having one's cake and eating it, Arabella Weir, when you were quite young and you suddenly got offered a job, I remember reading, in a new production of Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, it was going to be, I think. However, there was one major caveat which was only mentioned at the last moment.
Yes, as anybody familiar with the piece will know, the whole of the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie hangs on the fact that the man Miss Brodie has set her cap at is an art teacher, and he is discovered having got one of his students to pose naked, obviously unthinkable in those days. And the whole play and all the discussions about morals and everything hangs on that scene in which the very insouciant student is happy to pose naked. And I was offered that part in a production at the Musselburgh Theatre outside Edinburgh. And
you didn't realise at first that this was part of the
I didn't realise it was integral to the piece, but it absolutely is. I mean, the girl has to be naked because that's what's so shocking, that she's accepted it, that the art teacher has asked her to do it, that Miss Brodie's reaction to it, everything. But once I'd found out that I had to be naked, I still accepted the part, but always in my head knowing that I would never, ever, ever, ever do it. And I can't think now what kind of madness made me think. I must have been so convinced of my own ability to con people that I somehow thought, well, when it comes to it, I'll sever one of my legs or I'll make it literally impossible for me to be naked. And I have no idea to this day how I thought I was going to do that. And luckily for me, the very restrained county council of those days, this is 25 years ago, withdrew permission to do the play because they thought it'd be too shocking for the Musselburgh audiences. And they have little idea of how shocking it would have been had I been naked.
They might all have started singing the Sky Boat Song as they moved away.
Yes. Now,
and in fact, this was a song that your granny liked. We're getting through your family quite happily, aren't we?
Yes, well, my granny Chichi, who used to play this on the piano, was in fact my mother's stepmother, but she'd been my mother's stepmother since my mother was 20. Her mother had died when my mother was 18. And she was the most wonderful, loving woman, but less well-educated than my mother's parents, and more homey, if you like, and very, very Scottish, in a sort of refined-ish way. But she had a Scottish accent, which my mother's parents had not, because they were from a higher stock. And she was an extremely loving, warm person who really had a huge influence on mine and my siblings' lives. And she always played the Sky Boat Song and sang along. Not very well. Granny wasn't a great singer. I mean, she could keep a tune, but, you know, she wasn't a great singer. And it's very evocative of Scotland, obviously, but also of Scottish holidays at my granny's and of my parents' heritage.
Speed
Bonnie boat, like a bird on a wing, onward the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king over the sea to sky. Loud the winds howl, loud the waves roar, thunderclaps rend the air. Baffled our foes, stand by the shore, follow they will not dare. Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on the wing, onward the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king, over the sea to sky. Burn all our homes, exile and death, scatter the loyal men. Yet ere the sword cool in the sheath, Charlie will come again. Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on a wing, onward the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king over the sea to sky. Over the sea to
Needless to say, my granny did not have a snare drum, and I wouldn't necessarily approve of that rendition completely.
I really wish they hadn't got one.
Yes, but
it was
the
irredeemably cheerful. Pa, pa.
But the accordion was nice, because that's always very evocative of Scotland too. But, you know, it's a nice song.
The Sky Boat Song, as rendered by the Alexander Brothers. Well, finally, you were talking earlier, Arabella, we're about you having to con people sometimes. And
all the time.
An element of that is certainly required in the case of our next piece and the performer.
Yes. I used to go, when I was a student, to the Royal Opera House in the days when you could queue up. I don't know whether you can still do it, but opera didn't seem... I've got more money now than I did then, but opera seems ludicrously expensive now.
There are ways of doing it.
Yes, but you've got to sort of be there in the rain and all that. I mean, I'd like to know I was going tonight. I don't want to have to go down there, wait in the rain. And anyway, in those days, we used to go, me and a great friend and I, used to go and queue up and get, I think they were £5 at the Royal Opera House. This would be 30 years ago, more. And I saw many, many great singers. And the first time I saw Traviata live was with the not slender Montserrat Caballé. And she was an amazing singer, but perhaps not ideal for someone dying of consumption, which I think makes you quite thin. And she's a long way from thin. But this is a great opera. And again, my dad would think it was too light to waste his time with, but it's pretty good fun.
And this is a wonderful aria from Act One, isn't it?
Yes, and I, in my flat in my youth, would sing it along with her because I had a recording of this. And I had a pretty good voice, if you ask me, and a bit less fat.
Il giorno mio, sempre lieto, lei di cruire. I defy anyone not to stand to their feet when they've heard that. She is fantastic, cakes notwithstanding.
Montserrat Caballé singing Violetta and Carlo Begonzi, Alfredo, with the RCA Italian Opera Orchestra conducted by Georges Prêtre. And that was Sempre Libera from La Traviata, Act 1, by Verdi. Well, thank you very much, Arabella Weir.
Thank you.
You gave us earlier a little moment of Alfredella. And given what you assailed me with during that rendition, and I'd like to forewarn our engineer and all dogs that might be listening, instead of saying goodbye, I was just wondering if you could give us a little rendition of the top of your voice, a la Montserrat Caballé.
I'll see if I can do it. Not very tuneful, but, you know, quite a high note.
Quite impressive.
Arabella Weir was talking to Michael Barclay. And Michael's guest next Sunday, Remembrance Sunday, will be the Czech former actress Zdenka Fantlova, who, against all the odds, survived internment in several Nazi concentration camps, including Theresienstadt and Bergen-Belsen. Well, talking of Alfredella, there's some Alfredella on Radio 3 Request. That's today at 2 o'clock, presented by Fiona Talkington.
On BBC Two, the historian Richard Miles takes us on a journey from early Mesopotamia to ancient Rome.
In telling the stories of the first great civilizations, I'm going to be making the case for civilization itself.
And discovers how these civilizations laid the foundations for the modern world.
It's not the story of ancient worlds long past. It's a story of us then.
Ancient Worlds begins Wednesday night at 9 on BBC Two.
This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 92 FM on digital radio and also online. The time is 1 o'clock, time for the news with David Cornett.
The government is due to set out plans to force those who are unemployed for more than a year to carry out unpaid community work or risk losing their benefits. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, has criticised the proposals, saying they risked sending people into a downward spiral of despair. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, said they'd help people to gain the skills they needed to get back into work. People in Burma have voted in the country's first general election for two decades. Most candidates were from two large parties linked to the military. Opposition candidates faced obstacles to taking part and complained of voter intimidation. Foreign observers were banned. The US President, Barack Obama, who's on a visit to India, described the vote as anything but free and fair. A march will be held in Lossiemouth in Murray this afternoon, calling for the town's RAF base to be saved. There are fears that the Tornado aircraft based there will be transferred to Norfolk. The Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, says no decisions have been made. The Deputy Labour leader, Harriet Harman, has said the former Immigration Minister, Phil Woolas, has no future as a Labour MP, even if he succeeds in overturning a ruling which stripped him of his seat. An election court decided on Friday that he'd said things, knowing they were untrue, about his Liberal Democrat opponent. The Formula One world champion Jenson Button has escaped unhurt after an armed gang attacked his car near the Interlagos circuit in the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo. His driver forced his way through the traffic and escaped from the danger. Pope Benedict has consecrated the Sagrada Familia Church in Barcelona, the most famous creation of the architect Antoni Gaudí. It was begun in 1882, it's not yet finished, and won't be for at least another 15 years. And the weather, a bright but chilly day for most places. There may be some scattered showers in southeast England with a risk of hail. Winds will strengthen in the west with rain for Northern Ireland by dusk. BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
With David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. I mentioned Radio 3 Requests a couple of minutes ago. Also in that programme, performances by Victoria de Los Angeles and Gundula Janowitz, an unusual version of Saint-Saëns Danse Macabre, and the composer John Metcalf explains why Ravel's Piano Concerto is his idea of musical heaven. That's followed at 4 o'clock by Choral Evensong, another chance to hear Wednesday's service from New College, Oxford, with music by Herbert Howells, John Blow and Bach. But now it's time for The Early Music Show. Lucy Skeeping presents highlights of a concert recorded at this year's Schwetzingen Festival.
An improvisation on a traditional Sephardi song. And applause there from the packed audience at the Rococo Theatre in Schwetzingen. The performers for the whole of today's programme are an ensemble led by the famous gamba player Jordi Savall, not his regular early music group, Hesperian 20, but for this concert he was joined by three outstanding musicians whose musical roots represent a broader culture. The Moroccan oud player Driss El Maloumi, Greek guitarist Dimitri Personis, and the Spanish percussionist Pedro Esteban. The concert was given as part of the 2010 Schwetzingen Festival, and it featured an intriguing mix of music from all around the Mediterranean and beyond, from the Pyrenees as far east as Afghanistan. We've actually begun at the end of their performance with their encore. Well, why not? And for the rest of today's programme, we'll be hearing some more highlights. So lots of lovely music to enjoy over the next hour. The Sephardi repertoire, as many of you will know, is the music of the Spanish Jews. Sephard is the Hebrew word for Spain. It's a definition that's sometimes used quite loosely, though, because actually from 1492, Spain's joint monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, expelled all the Jews from the peninsula. Some stayed and converted to Christianity, although even they were never entirely left to live in peace, while others packed their belongings and travelled eastwards to Greece, Turkey, Egypt and North Africa, where they made their new homes. Their culture and their Spanish language they took with them. And so we find a whole host of wonderful and often very moving traditional Sephardi songs and melodies that were collected, many of them in the 20th century, in countries along the eastern Mediterranean and far, of course, from their Spanish roots. We'll hear the group perform another one in this next set, an instrumental version of an old love song, El Amor Yo No Sabia, that's thought to come from the old city of Smyrna in modern-day Turkey. First, though, we'll hear something that comes from one of the most extraordinary collections of music that's come down to us today from medieval times, the so-called Cantigas of Santa Maria. This anthology of songs and instrumental dances was put together in the 13th century by King Alfonso X of Castile, otherwise known as Alfonso the Wise, and wise he certainly was, an intellectual, a scientist, a linguist and a philosopher whose ideas on human rights is a lesson to us all. He may have been a devoted Christian, but at his court were Muslims and Jews whose own particular style so enriched the music.